This podcast brought to you by Hope 103.2.
Hello and welcome to the Hope Mornings Weekly podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. This week, Tony Abbott faced mutiny over his decision to confer a knighthood onto Prince Philip. In our new segment, Weekly Perspective, Carl Fayes looks at why this decision was so controversial and what it says about our national culture and values. Colleen McCulloch passed away this week at the age of 77. Her publisher, Shona Martin, shares some insights into her character and her work. The kids went back to school this week. Colette Smart has some tips on making the transition easier for everyone. Still, Alice is at the movies. It's the story of a 50-year-old professor dealing with early-onset dementia. Former MP John Watkins, the CEO of Alzheimer's Australia New South Wales, will fill us in on the latest facts about the illness. Mark Hadley looks ahead at the new crop of TV being offered up in 2015. And former High Five star and musical theatre performer Tim Madron drops by for a chat about his latest cinema project. That's all coming up in the Hope Mornings Weekly podcast. Don't forget you can download it from the Hope 103.2 website or subscribe on iTunes. Just search for Hope Media and select the Hope Mornings Weekly podcast. I'm Katrina Rowe. Thanks for listening. Today, we are starting a brand new segment with Christian media commentator Carl Fayes, where we look back on a big issue from the week and try to understand its implications from a Christian perspective. Now, this week, everybody has been talking about Tony Abbott's controversial decision to knight Prince Philip. Why has this issue alienated so many Australians? Carl Fayes is on the line to talk us through it. G'day, Carl.
Great to be with you and looking forward to our new spot on a weekly basis.
Yeah, I found this whole thing quite fascinating. You know, the fact that one decision has caused so much doubt about Tony Abbott's leadership and his judgment. In your view, Carl, did this show an error of judgment by Tony Abbott?
Well, I mean, it has to, in the sense that, as they keep saying this week, politically, this decision has no friends. People are willing to kind of say we still like Tony, but there's a sense that nobody's out there defending this as a good decision, which is almost unheard of, really. Normally, there's a decision where people can see the pros and the cons, and people come out against one side or for the other side, and you get a bit of a balance of commentary and political opinion. In this one, there's no friends. In one way, as a lot of people have said, this is a bit irrelevant. It doesn't really matter. If we knight Prince Philip or not, what difference does it make to Australia's future, the economy, our culture, anything? But on another, the big problem is that it sort of goes to the heart of character and judgment. And I think that's okay. The big question rolling around this issue.
Well, why do you think this particular decision has just been so unpopular? I heard one statistic in the news that only 12% of Australians actually support the decision. Why does it rub up against us so badly?
Yeah, I mean, that's why I think this is a really interesting problem or issue to think about, because what it goes to the heart of is not commentary and politics and left versus right. It goes to the heart of what's our culture? What are the things that are kind of key to our culture? What are the things that we hold as being important and that we value? And what people are saying in general is that I think that Tony Abbott seems to have missed what we see as important. I mean, I think what we see as important are things like we have this sort of egalitarian sense about it. Now, that might be breaking down a little, but this sense, we honour people that do well and we respect them. And I don't know that we necessarily cut off every tall poppy, but we don't like people who try and pretend or act they're better than everybody else. We'll really like you if you're successful, but just come across like everybody else does.
You know,
people like Jerry Harvey and John Singleton, no great airs and graces. They're just, you know, knockabout blokes who happen to have made squillions of dollars.
Yeah.
We don't like that. We also honour the selfless people. I mean, I think about the great honour that the late Fred Hollows has held in. You know, here's an eye surgeon, I guess, eye specialist, who spent his time the back blocks of Australia, in the kind of deserts of Africa, cataract operations. And Catherine Hamlin and her husband are with the fistula hospitals in Africa. And their stories are talked about, there's this resounding sense from Australians like, that's great.
Yeah, we're
that's
proud great. Of them, aren't we?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. But, you know, you look at the Australia Day honours and you look at people like Rosie Batty and Juliet Wright and, you know, they are the battlers and they're people who've been through things or whatever, but they are, like you said, they're doing something for others.
My thing is I think Australia Day honours are a great thing to do, because what they tend to do, as you just mentioned, is pick out people like Rosie Batty. What a great choice. Mm. And there's this resounding yes from the community, because we want to honour those people. And I think that's what Australia Day Honours ought to do. They ought to look around the community very closely and go, here's a person that represents the values of our nation and the values that we want to honour, and let's make heroes of those people. It's such a kind of godly trait of a nation. I mean, here we are as a secular nation. You know, no one would pretend Australia is a Christian nation, really, although there's a bit of discussion around that. Mm. But the values that sit behind honouring the person who selflessly serves are actually very Christian values. Paul says, consider other people better than yourself. Don't put yourself first. Put others better than yourself. Jesus talked about himself as someone who came to not to be served, but to serve and give his life for other people. The last shall be first and the first shall be last. Those kind of foundational Christian values that says we're not here for ourselves, we're here for other people. And what Australia Day Honours, I think, do at their best is that they actually pick that out. And the great thing is that Australians look at that and go, that's a good thing.
Yeah, yep, that's right. Yeah, so maybe inside this whole debacle, there is actually something very positive and about our culture and about our values. So we should be proud of that too.
And I actually think it represents the Christian heritage, the kind of foundational Christian values that our community was built on.
Yeah. Okay, thank you, Carl. Good to chat with you.
Pleasure.
Appreciate your point of view. That's Carl Faze with our new segment, Weekly Perspective. And this week we've been talking about Tony Abbott's decision to knight Prince Philip. Colleen McCulloch, one of Australia's most prolific and successful authors, passed away yesterday, aged 77, at Norfolk Island. Her publisher, Shona Martin, from HarperCollins Australia, is on the line to pay her respects this morning. Hi, Shona.
Hi there.
This is a sad day for you, isn't it?
It is. Look, Cole had poor health and, in fact, poor sight for a number of years, but she was such a feisty soul. I suppose each time there was a health scare, we always hoped that she would rally back, but sadly this time it wasn't to be.
Yeah, was she still able to write with all her health challenges that she had?
Well, yeah, she could dictate. I mean, her mind was very alert. And just recently, we found her on the internet, an old-fashioned dictaphone player, you know, those ones from the 80s with the big buttons. And
yeah.
She was dictating her latest novel into that. So she was very alert and still thinking of new storylines.
Oh, will we ever see that one she was working on, Shona? Or?
Probably not. I think she had got to through about a third of it. But I'm just thrilled that she was able to keep working, because that was really her passion and was a stimulation for her living.
Yeah. Let's talk about Thornbirds a little bit, because I understand it's one of the most successful and enduring, you know, Australian novels. What was her attitude to her work? Like, how did she feel about what she produced?
She was very proud of what she produced, and she also was proud that it connected with a broad audience, that she wasn't part of a sort of a stuffy literary circle.
Yeah.
I mean, the Thornbirds sales were amazing. We believe it's 30 million paperbacks and 3 million hardbacks, but it was also significant because in the 1970s, for a unknown, effectively, woman writer, an Australian too, to get an advance from an American publisher, our colleagues at Harper & Row, for more than $1 million was hugely significant. And I think Colleen's success inspired a huge amount of women and just, you know, potential writers generally. I mean, I remember reading it as a teenager and, you know, never thought that I would actually work with her.
I read it as a teenager as well, and it was just beguiling. You know, you couldn't put it down.
Yeah.
Is it true that The Thornbirds is Australia's best-selling novel of all time?
Yes. I think that it would be hard to think of any other book that could match that. And, of course, Colleen continued on selling extraordinary numbers. Even her last book, Bittersweet, sold close to 70,000 copies, which came out in 2013. Australians loved her books, but Colleen herself liked to write different types of stories. So she would move around, you know, she would write books about ancient Rome. She would write crime novels. And for a very long time, she resisted doing anything like another sweeping saga. She kept complaining that, you know, publishers would always want her to do Thornbirds too, but she liked to write different types of books.
Yeah, well, men loved the Rome series as well.
They did.
Yeah. Now, she was obviously a very, very clever lady, but how would you describe her personality? What was she like to work with?
Oh, look, she was quite feisty. She didn't suffer fools. So, you know, she would have opinions about things like, I don't know, going to voicemail. She'd like to ring and get straight on to you and so on. But she was a perfectionist. And she was a woman who was, I think, inspired by the nuns who taught her at the convent school in Willara. I think that really was the thing that opened up her mind. She had a tremendous intellect and so on. But certainly, you know, she was a woman of opinion. You didn't really mess with Cole, but she also had the most fantastic laugh. Her laugh was, you know, raucous and slightly sexy, slightly crazy, but you know, she gave a lot of joy to the people that she was close to.
Yeah, I can only imagine you must feel an enormous gratitude at sort of having had this opportunity to work so closely
with her.
Of course, yes. Any memorable moments that, you know, from your time together?
Well, the thing that I always looked forward to the most was that Colleen, when she sent her manuscripts in, sent them in these special custom-made boxes. They were maroon sort of fabric boxes with her name embossed on them that she'd had in, made in New York at some shop, which I suspect, you know, provided things to writers in the 1950s. Cole kept using these. So, you know, these days when everything, you know, is mostly submitted to publishers digitally, to get these boxes arriving from Norfolk Island, you know, was always a moment of great excitement. People would gather around and gasp.
Oh, that's a treasure. I mean, they have to end up in a museum one day, those boxes with the manuscripts in them. I mean, that's just, as you said, so rare. Well, before I let you go, Shona, did you have a favourite Colleen McCulloch book yourself? Obviously, you would be familiar with her entire catalogue. What's the one that just really grips you?
Look, it's hard to pick, isn't it? I mean, look, I think The Thornbirds has to be admired because of the achievement it was. But Bittersweet, the most recent book, which had two feisty sets of twins set in the 1920s, I actually really responded to because it was another book with such a message about strong women and opportunity. And I think that underpinned a lot of Colleen's work, whether she was writing about Cleopatra or, you know, nurses in the Southern Highlands. So that's probably, you know, a more recent favourite.
Okay. Well, thank you so much, Shona, for taking some time to talk about it today.
Thank you for remembering Cole.
Yeah. That's Shona Martin. She is Colleen McCulloch's publisher over at HarperCollins. Colleen passed away yesterday, age 77. Many New South Wales public schools go back to school today or tomorrow, and that means parents are busy packing lunch boxes, gathering supplies, getting everything in order. And there's always mixed feelings when a little one is starting school or perhaps starting at a new school for the first time. It's exciting to see your baby take that big step, but it's also the end of an era and the beginning of a new adventure, I guess. Colette Smart from Family Smart is on the line to talk us through. Hey, Colette.
Good morning.
Now, what changes have you got going on in your family this year?
Oh, so I've just finished the big morning rush this morning. I can't stand doing lunches, and I can't stand that part of doing school stuff. But I've got a child starting high school this year. My eldest has already been in high school 2 years, and then my youngest is going into year one. So we did all that this morning. And you see with children, they play out their anxieties in different ways. I had one extremely grumpy, and that's that child's way of expressing anxiety. I had one saying they were sick all the way to school, just feeling car sick. Another one who didn't stop talking the entire way. So everybody was expressing their emotions, while their anxiety came out differently. So, yeah, it's been...
It's interesting, isn't it? Sometimes I think the parents are more emotional about it than the kids, you know, like particularly when little ones are either starting kindy or starting high school, and the parents are the ones going, oh, my baby's growing up. How do we make sure we don't pass on, you know, those anxieties to our kids?
They pick up your emotions and they're so attuned to your emotions. I had to keep myself in check just thinking, oh my goodness, I've got another high school child. Where's the time gone? But I had to kind of remain upbeat, also not let myself bounce off their emotions, you know, the high anxiety, and just try and stay as even tempered as I could today. I think that was important. And then show your emotion to your friends. Call a friend or call your mum later on and cry once you've dropped your kindy child off, or just talk through your fears with somebody else. I think your children need you to just be even and just show them that you're in control, that they're safe. I think that's a very important part of them starting school.
I mean, all children have to be feeling anxious about starting high school. That is always going to be something so new and different if they're going to a new school. But then also just for the little ones, it's such a big change, isn't it, too, just from going to just being at home or being at preschool a couple of days, you know, to then going to school.
And even children just changing from one year to the next. You know, my youngest started kindy last year, but he was going into year one this year. So just talking through with your children how everybody's feeling anxious this week, everybody feels strange going to a new classroom with or meeting a new teacher. Mm. I even spoke to my children this morning about the fact that there will be new teachers there who will feel anxious themselves.
Yes, true.
In a staff room with brand new people that they don't know. And so it suddenly normalizes that feeling of a bit of stress for them, that everybody feels it. I think kindy kids, obviously it's important, practice putting jumpers on, turning jumpers inside out, practice opening lunch packets, spending, you know, a bit of time just organizing play dates over the next few weeks once you hear a few names pop up. The same with high school students, just kind of listening for new names, trying to organize a few outings with new students sometime during this term. Definitely go through transport routes, bus routes, train routes with them. Even your high school students, if initially for a week or two they need you to pick them up from school, if you can, or drop them off at school occasionally, that alleviates their anxiety. And then your high school students will definitely still need supervision with sorting through timetables, packing their bags, knowing which subjects to pack for. Mm. That's a whole new ball game. They suddenly try and lug 10 subjects worth of textbooks and everything every day. Rather, you know, help them to work through their timetable. Color coding. For high school students, color coding their subjects. It sounds simple, but it's very good for them. They just can pick out a book or something for English might be pink or blue. It's very good to help organisation for them.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, look, I remember that first week of high school. I remember being so lost, having no idea which classroom I was meant to be in, being late for every class. Yeah, I think teenagers particularly, that they need that bit of extra sympathy.
Absolutely. I think giving them scripts, you know, saying, I'm in year seven, I'm not sure where I should be. Tell them it's okay to say that.
Yeah.
Teachers expect you to not know where you're supposed to be. Give them, and all of your kids, give them little lines to say, like, hi, my name's Jack. What sport do you like to play? Or what did you get any new Xbox games this holiday? Just giving them lines so that they've got an in when they meet new students.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for some of those practical tips, Colette.
Thank you.
Great to chat to you as always. And I hope your kids all go well this week.
Thanks so much.
Okay. That's Colette Smart from Family Smart talking about back to school. The movie Still Alice is gaining lots of attention this awards season. Julianne Moore has already won a Best Actress Golden Globe, a Critics' Choice Award, a Screen Actors Guild Award, and is now considered to be the favourite to pick up the Best Actress Oscar after five previous nominations. Based on a novel, it tells the story of a 50-year-old professor who finds she has early onset Alzheimer's. Now, for a lot of people who have a loved one with Alzheimer's or some other kind of dementia, the film will no doubt bring up some very powerful emotions and probably a few questions as well. To help us out, the Honourable John Watkins, the CEO of Alzheimer's Australia New South Wales, is on the line. Hi, John.
Hello, Katrina.
Now, in the film, the character of Alice has got this sort of early onset Alzheimer's. How common is that?
Well, we call that younger onset dementia, and that refers to people who develop dementia probably in their 60s or under 65. And it is probably more common than people think. People developing different forms of dementia in their 40s, 50s, and into their 60s. Dementia is really most common as people age, but there are a certain number of people who, for some reason, we don't know why, do develop it early. And across Australia today, There's about 25,000 people under the age of 65 that are living with dementia. That's out of a total of about 330,000 people that are diagnosed with dementia, mostly older people, but about 25,000 under the age of 65. So not hugely common, but it is, it is an issue.
It's a lot, though, 25,000. It's a lot more than you would expect.
Yes, it is. People think of dementia as an older person's, you know, disease, 80s and 90s. But yes, it does happen. About less than 1% of the population under 65, but it does happen, and it's something we'll increasingly hear about.
One of my callers yesterday said, you know, my grandfather went that way, my mother's gone that way, I'll probably go that way too. Is it a hereditary illness?
There is one particular type which is in the genetics, and if your mum or dad's got it, you'll get it, but that's very, very rare. Is dementia hereditary? Well, as much as any condition is. If your parents died of or developed cancer or heart disease, you have an increased risk of that as a child. And the same too with dementia. If your parents had dementia, you've got an increased risk. But that means that you can also reduce the risk. So if the hereditary risk is higher, take steps to reduce the risk in other ways. So,
what can we do? That's what we all want to know, John. Yeah, what can we do?
A brain-healthy lifestyle, and that basically means be fit and healthy, don't smoke, don't drink to excess, look after your weight, get your blood pressure under control, all of those things that also bring benefit to your heart and your vascular system, but remain socially and mentally active as you age. Continue to use your brain, learn new things, learn a language, join a club, argue with people about politics. Join
Oh, my dad's not going to get it then. That's great. Yep, thanks for that.
But those people who tend to retire from work and then retire from life and lead a very sedentary lifestyle probably increase the risk. But in particular, more and more research is pointing towards the importance of daily exercise as a way of slowing the risk or perhaps even preventing the development of dementia.
It's interesting because, you know, you're just saying all the things we hear again and again, you know, not to be smoking, to be active, to eat well.
We don't listen too well, do we?
That's right. I guess for those who are already dealing with this illness, though, it is a very stressful illness on families. And do you have any kind of advice for people who are dealing with a loved one having dementia? How can they make it less painful?
Katrina, it is difficult, and especially in its later stages, and very distressing for many people who are carers. But when it first comes your way, the most important thing is to get prepared, be informed, get a proper diagnosis. Unfortunately, it often takes years to get that diagnosis. Get help from Alzheimer's Australia. We've got a huge amount of information that can provide some comfort. Get help from your community, from your family. Organise rosters. Think towards the future and plan. But the thing that I think people fear most is that somehow the person that develops dementia will somehow drift away from them or not be the person that they've known and loved. And that's not entirely true. Even though people develop dementia, they're still that person that you knew and loved and grew up with. They're still there. And our greatest responsibility towards them, I think, is tolerance, love and kindness. And I've seen many people now live with an aged parent who drifts off into pretty severe dementia, but there can still be love in that relationship and still be comfort.
Finally, before I let you go, are we likely to see a cure for Alzheimer's in our lifetime?
I don't think we'll get a bullet that says, here's a tablet you can take and that'll stop it dead. I think we're going to get much better about risk factors and people particularly who are at risk and probably get early warning that a particular person may develop it, and then they may be able to take steps themselves to slow the progression of the disease. I think it's going to be more particular rather than a general cure.
Okay. Thank you so much for filling us in with some of the facts today.
That's a pleasure, Katrina.
Yeah,
thank you.
Really appreciate it. That's John Watkins, the CEO of Alzheimer's Australia New South Wales, answering some of the common questions that you might have about dementia and Alzheimer's. Well, a new year means a new crop of TV shows. So what can we expect on the small screen in 2015? More of the same old singing, cooking and renovating shows? Or is there something really fresh and exciting just over the horizon? Mark Hadley, our TV reviewer, has picked out some of the highlights and possibly some of the lowlights as well. Hi, Mark.
Hey, Katrina. How are you?
Yeah, well, thanks. Now, for those who love a good historical drama, this is the year of the Anzacs. I mean, I've already seen bus shelters advertising the Nine series Gallipoli, but I believe that nearly every Australian network's got a Gallipoli offering this year. Is that right, Mark?
Oh, look, there's no nearly about it. Absolutely everyone does have something about Gallipoli on the slate. And if you've been living in a bubble by accident, you've missed the fact that this is the centenary of the Anzacs landing at Gallipoli. So Seven's got one, you know, Gallipoli, the Power of Ten, and that's hosted by, you know, a decorated soldier, Ben Robert Smith. And look, everybody, the ABC, you pick whoever, they've all got one going.
And which is the one that you're most interested in?
I think at this stage I'm interested in the Nine Network's Gallipoli. Now, this sounds strange for me, even when I say those words, that I'm interested in the Nine Network. Nine has been playing a sort of a line that's drifting more towards the lower end of the market as it tries to scrape more of the ratings together now that Seven has taken control of Australian television. And so there hasn't been much to celebrate on Nine, I'm afraid. Mm. But they're doing a series called Gallipoli, which is actually co-written by Australia's most respected historian in this area, Les Cullen. And Les is basically legendary when it comes to accuracy and research in relationship to Gallipoli.
Okay, so it could be good.
Oh, look, I think even though Nine has stacked this sort of drama series about a 17-year-old boy who lies about his age to, you know, follow his big brother into the Great War, even though they've stacked it with soap stars, the fact that it's actually got real credibility in terms of its research will probably make it not just memorable television, but also powerful, instructive television.
Yeah, that's cool. There's also some true life crime on the agenda, isn't there? With a sort of underbelly style, you know, Ivan Milat thing. It sounds gruesome and wholly unedifying. Well, what do you know about that?
The thing about this year is it's going to be nostalgic television. So not only are we looking back to Gallipoli, but we're looking back to other big moments in Australian history, and some of them aren't that old. Catching Milat is the Seven Network's series, and they've promoted it as an underbelly style drama. If you don't know anything about Ivan Milat, he was the man at the centre of the backpacker killers.
The Belangolo thing, right?
Belangolo State Forest, where I actually came into journalism. So it was one of my first big sort of stories. And personally, I'm sort of going, oh gosh, this was a gruesome thing that unfolded. It'd be interesting to see it laid out in sort of docudrama style. Or it could be exactly what they said, an underbelly style drama. And if that's the case, you know, we're going to be looking at basically some really unhelpful things.
Yeah, I can't get into those kind of shows. I just find them too kind of glorifying of that kind of underworld.
When we sit in judgment on it and sit there and enjoy, in one respect, be entertained by what they've done, I think we've missed the point.
Mm. And what can we expect in the reality TV genre? More cooking shows? I think I've seen ads for MKR already.
Katrina, this is the year. This is the year where it all comes together. Or it all goes down the plug hole. I mean, I don't know what to say. Channel 7 is basically has had such a huge success with My Kitchen Rules that it's going to be running two seasons of it. And it's also had... I know, so we get to watch it twice this year. It's also had great success with House Rules. So if you can get success with a cooking book and you can get success with renovation, well, heck, why not combine them? So Channel 7 is doing Kitchen Revolution, basically. Firstly...
Are they going to sing as well in the kitchen?
Well, no. Well, if they bring that in, if it's the voice of Kitchen Revolution next year, then you and I will have predicted the next format. But basically what's happening is that, firstly, couples get to renovate, I mean physically build their restaurant, and then they get to cook in it for the public. One of the interesting things about this is that I'm not too thrilled about is they're borrowing a line from Recipe to Riches. And you might remember that's the show where you could actually buy the stuff that was being cooked the very next day, you know, in the shops. What actually happens here is during the program, you can buy the tools, you can buy the cooking implements, and this is what, you know, programmers call highly integrated television. Mm. What I call it is programming prostitution.
Yes.
Basically, you're going to see Channel 7 turn themselves into a shopping channel for five nights a week.
Right.
And I personally don't think we need that.
All right. Well, now let's scrape right to the bottom of the barrel just briefly. What's the most lowly anticipated show of 2015? What's the one that's got you reaching for the remote already?
I've got to say, I am probably the only person who is going to have to watch this, but everybody else should maybe take a wide berth. Channel 9 is introducing Married at First Sight.
How does that work?
Just think about the title.
What, you marry someone you've never met before?
They're going to bring perfect strangers together and marry them. and we'll see what happens.
Oh, wow. What's that going to do to the divorce rate?
I know.
Seriously.
Look, I mean, already 6% of divorces in Australia are happening in the first year, 33% in the first five. I mean, we really don't need programming that encourages people to take marriage less seriously.
No.
And Channel 9 taking it and turning what should be, as far as the Bible's concerned, a lifelong commitment into a TV season stunt, you know, it's just going to be sad.
Thanks, Mark. Thanks so much. That's Mark Hadley. We've been speaking about the new crop of TV shows for 2015. For mums and dads, the faces on our kids' favourite TV shows become like familiar old friends. We recognise Jimmy Giggle, The Wiggles and Justine Clark. They're spread throughout our cars and homes on backpacks, lunchboxes and DVD covers. Well, Tim Madron is one of those familiar faces. He starred in many Australian theatre productions like The Addams Family and The Rocky Horror Show, but he's best known for being part of the children's music group High Five. He's now got a fun new project on the boil that he wants to tell us about. G'day, Tim. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks, Katrina. Thank you for having me.
Now, High Five, we've got to talk about that to start with. It's been around for such a long time. I remember it starting up when I was working at Wynn Television in 1999. And I was in the production room. We'd all sit there sneakily watching it at 9 o'clock in the morning. How did it become part of your life?
I've got lots of nieces and nephews.
Yeah.
And I think when it came to auditioning for the show, and naturally I trained as a singer, dancer, actor.
You went through WAPA, didn't you, in Western Australia? Yeah.
Yeah. So I'd done quite a few musicals before, so I was across those sorts of skills. And then with the opportunity to be part of the kids' world, it seemed like a natural fit. Because at that time, my nieces and nephews were aged between 2 to sort of 6 years old. So I get that world.
So you were that fun uncle that used to turn up right on bedtime and stir them up, right, just before they're meant to go to sleep?
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And now my brother-in-law is threatening, as soon as I start having kids, is threatening that he's going to, as soon as it's bedtime, he's like, right, kids, red frogs.
No, but he'll be too old to be fun by then, so don't worry about it. What did you learn from those? You know, it was, I think, 4 years, 3 albums, 135 episodes. What did your performing gain from being part of that High Five where you're just constantly, constantly filming and performing?
After I finished High Five, I've done Addams Family and Rocky Horror. Yeah. And you know, you go to opening nights and everyone's very supportive and, you know, great. And then you find out what they think of you in the paper the next day. With children, if you don't cut the mustard, that they'll yell out, "You're boring me. They're awesome." And what I learned from that was it's an incredible way to perform for kids because, one, they're not as reliant on vocab as we are. Mm. So they go with their gut. So you have to be an honest performer. And if you're faking it, they'll know. And that was sort of the biggest thing I learned
so
with children.
Interesting that you said that, Tim, because I was speaking to Sam Moran, who, you know, is the children's performer, and he was the former Yellow Wiggle.
Yeah.
And he said the same thing. He said, with kids, you've either got them or you've lost them, and you know, you know.
Yeah, they'll let you know.
Yeah.
When I was in the Perth Convention Centre, it was absolutely filled with people. And we had this wall that we would go back and forth from. Anyway, we went back to the wall and we were pulling stuff out of the wall and we turned around and somehow a little girl had jumped up on stage. She was wearing angel wings and had this sort of halo and this white dress. And the spotlight had fallen straight on her.
Right.
And we turned around and it was the most amazing vision of her just standing there seeing her heroes. And we stopped the show. And we picked her up and said hi and had a little chat with her and everything like that. And it was such a beautiful moment because all the audience were on board. We were on board.
Yeah.
And this child was keen to just have a little chat and have a little conversation with
us all, isn't it?
As a performer, you really have to be able to take moments like that and run with them and feel comfortable to do that.
Yeah, every other mum and every other child in the audience would have been mesmerised by it.
And you can't fake that. So that's what I really love about that sort of industry.
Now, it was fun seeing Feli Irvine on The Voice last season. But what are the other High Five members that you worked with doing now?
Yep. So Lauren has started up her own company called Lolly Bolly. So she makes clothing for girls.
Oh, wow.
Stevie's still in the group.
That's a long time for him, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is. And he loves it. Like, he's just a natural fit for that. And this is something that meant a lot to us as a group. And charities and giving back to the community means a lot to him. And so being able to do that through High Five is a great fit for him. So he's doing well. And Feli, she's, her career's really going from strength to strength with with After The Voice. Like, she's doing lots of gigs everywhere.
Oh, that's great. And what about Casey? What's she up to?
Yeah, she does lots of live performing gigs.
Okay.
And then also she's a Pilates instructor. She's a big fitness fanatic. So okay. She's a Pilates instructor and I see her around Sydney quite a lot.
I can imagine for High Five you'd have to be fit and it would keep you fit because there's so much dancing going on in that show.
Yeah. So this is what a day would be like on tour.
Yeah.
So each show, because I can do a 3-hour musical or whatever like that, but it was nothing like a High Five show. So each show was an hour long. You would sing 15 dances. Your heart rate would be up the whole time.
Yeah.
Then you would come off stage. You would get some food. You would have a meet and greet for half an hour. And then an hour later, you'd be back on stage.
Wow.
And then you'd do that 3 times. So by the end of the day, and you can't, and it was really hard to describe to people. You had to eat the right food because if you ate too much, then you'd get stomach troubles on stage, which happened to me.
Not good.
Yeah. So you had to really make sure you're hydrated and all sorts of things as the day went on. Yeah. So it kept you very, very fit.
And you've got to have energy performing for kids, don't you?
Yeah.
So it sounds like you're still in touch with everyone and you're good friends, aren't you?
Yeah. We shared so much. Like, I mean, we had amazing memories. We were ambassadors for World Vision, so we went over to the Philippines once. But quite a few times we did World Vision things, but this one was a bit different. It was on a rubbish tip, and there were 30,000 people living on this rubbish tip, and we went around and met the kids and sort of learned about what World Vision was doing in the area. After an experience like that, you know, it's more than a job. It's more, you know, so we really did become brothers and sisters, and we do genuinely, like at my wedding, they were all at my wedding, and we do genuinely become, we've become good friends, and also you understand each other when you're on stage. You have to be at, so many things are happening all the time that you have to throw things to other people, and believe me, you're going to feel embarrassed very quickly in a merman costume if you don't feel safe around the other people. If you feel, and especially when we were filming, there was this sort of thing with the crew and cast that everyone has to be very supportive of each other, because if you're not genuine and you're not genuinely having fun, kids will pick up on that. It's a very special thing that we fought the whole time to make sure that what we stood for as a group, we lived. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, like, absolutely.
And
yeah,
we fought for that all the time. And I think that was a really, really good thing to do, because it meant that we could stand up on stage every day and genuinely go, this is a good thing for people. You know, because you would go to somewhere like the Philippines and you would see a picture of you on a skyscraper 20, 30 stories high, and you would realize that responsibility of what you're teaching to the new generation. So, and all of us did that, and all of us fought for that.
Well, that's encouraging to hear that. I'm speaking with Tim Madron. He's a theatre performer, and he was for many years part of High Five. But he's got a new project going, Hide and Seek Cinema, Tim. This is your little, I guess it's like a hobby or like a small business, is it?
As I said, like, I can turbocharge fun. So first day High Five, I actually, for all of us to get together, we got together at Balmoral Beach, and there's an island in the middle of Balmoral Beach.
Yeah, I had my hens night there.
It's a stunning area.
Yeah.
So I decided to make a treasure hunt on that island for everyone in High Five, and it was really funny seeing Casey, Fanny and Lauren especially turn into 5-year-olds running around going, "Where's the next crew? Where's the next crew?"
And you realise that even grown-ups like treasure hunts, right?
That's it. That's it. And that's what I do. I know how to have fun. Mm-hmm. And so I thought, why not be able to make that for more people? So Hide and Seek Cinema is basically that. I hide a cinema somewhere. People follow a sort of, there's an X marks the spot. People follow the clues to find the cinema. And as they go along, they sort of get an idea of what film's about to be played.
So they don't even know what movie they're going to.
No.
It'll be something family friendly, but
It's definitely something, definitely something family friendly, but it's something that I think sparks the imagination of people. So this, to give you an idea of what sort of happens, this one is I can talk about because I don't think it will happen for a few reasons, but
okay.
So imagine people turn up to an X that marks a spot, they follow the clues, somewhere like Balmoral, there's a place in Sydney which is somewhere like something like Balmoral Beach, which is sort of a walkway that surrounds the sort of the beach, and it's fenced off. And so they get to this area, and there's lilos everywhere. And so everyone hops on the water and, you know, hops on the lilos and stuff like that. And then all of a sudden the movie plays and it's Jaws.
Oh,
so,
wow.
So everyone watches Jaws on
a
lilo.
Yeah, and you're like, no!
Yeah.
That's a really fun idea. So tell us about the event that you've got coming up soon.
Yeah. Well, it's in Castle Craig. I found a door that I call it the door that stands for no reason. Like, there is a door that is there for no apparent reason.
Okay.
And so I thought that's a great place to sort of lay the X.
Yeah.
And then basically from there, you follow the clues. And as the treasure hunt progresses, you will get an idea of what's ahead of you.
Okay. And, so when's this happening? It's soon, right?
Next Saturday. Saturday, January 31st.
Saturday,
so it's
January
exciting.
January 31st at Castle Craig. And how can people get tickets?
Moshtix. I've aligned with Moshtix.
Okay.
So you can either go to the website, which is hideandseekcinema.com.au.
Yeah.
Or you can go to Moshtix and type Hide and Seek Cinema.
There. Thank you, Tim, for telling us about it. It's a really fun idea.
Yeah,
and I'm sure a lot of people will really enjoy getting along to that. That's Tim Madron, an actor and performer, best known for his role with High Five. He's also organising this Hide and Seek Cinema. So find out more. Just Google Hide and Seek Cinema or go to hideandseekcinema.com.au.
Yeah, that's it.
Cool. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Start your day with life words. Subscribe to Hope 1032's free daily email devotional at hope1032.com.au.